And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
What's it mean when whales wink? And what's a whale's wink got to do with what dogs think? We boldly go where others fear to venture into the worlds of anthropomorphosis. It's a special edition of The Voice of the Earth, where we speak, yes, for the animals that try to tell us what they feel and think when the Wild Side News continues. It's a show you're about to love.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Month 2 of the year 2006. Just a bit over a month and a half, and the Wild Side News will celebrate its second full year on air. It's been a most interesting journey, and I'm glad you can listen to this edition of The Voice of the Earth. I ran across an interesting story that must have gotten entangled in the wrappings and trappings over the holidays. It's the story of a 50-foot humpback whale that was streaming along the California coastline, south on its way to the Baja. She was cruising along, free and unencumbered, near the Farallon Islands, which lie about 18 miles off the shore from San Francisco, when she managed to get snagged by a crab trap line. Crab trap lines reach about 240 feet long, with weights 90 pounds each, about every 60 feet. In the effort to get free, the humpback spun and got ever more ensnared. By the time a fisherman discovered her, she was struggling to keep her blowhole above water. The crab fisherman discovered her at about 8:30 in the morning and put out a call to the Marine Mammal Center in Sausalito. The whale struggled for 6 hours until help finally arrived when three divers managed to reach her. They found her failing as the ropes had wrapped four times around her tail, had entangled in one of her front flippers, and was caught in her mouth. The divers quickly determined that the only hope was to cut the 20 tight nylon ropes away from her. It took an hour to do so, during which time she remained still except for an unusual shaking. James Mosquito, one of the divers, had the task of cutting the ropes from her mouth, and he clearly recalls what he experienced. He says, "When I was cutting the line going through the mouth, the whale's eye was there winking at me, watching me. It was an epic moment in my life." Eventually, after 7 hours of struggle, the animal was freed. Mosquito recalled what then happened. It began swimming around in circles, and then this 50-foot-long being, that with one swipe of its tail could kill any one of the divers, this humpback swam up to one of the divers and gave him a friendly, affectionate series of nudges. Then she swam to each of her other two rescuers and did the same. Mosquito said it was like a dog that was happy to see you. I never felt threatened. It was an amazing, unbelievable experience. Another diver said, "You hate to anthropomorphize too much, but the whale was doing little dives and the guys were rubbing shoulders with it. I don't know for sure what it was thinking, but it's something that I will always remember. It was just cool." It's yet another amazing story of interspecies communication. And it's what inspires today's show. So many of us are so afraid to acknowledge that animals are so much like us. We say, "We hate to anthropomorphize." Why? I think it's wrong not to, because the animals are very cognitive creatures who definitely share not only a capacity to communicate, but so much more. So today we celebrate anthropomorphization from three perspectives. It's told through our relationships with dogs. We start out with a story I tell about a dog named Apache. Then we talk with a woman who has been working with search and rescue dogs for years and end up with a phenomenal story about a canine companion, a dog named Hawk. Great stuff coming up following the news. And so, the news. President Bush, Tuesday night, delivered his State of the Union address to the nation and to the world. In what appeared to be a surprisingly bold pronouncement from this president was his statement that America is addicted to oil. And he proposed a series of technological initiatives to address this dependency. First, he announced that since 2001, we have spent $10 billion to develop cleaner, cheaper, and more reliable energy sources. And he announced a 22% increase in clean energy research at the Department of Energy. And third, he boldly stated his goal to replace more than 75% of our oil imports from the Middle East by 2025 and make our dependence on Middle Eastern oil a thing of the past. Some, however, have suggested that the devil may be in the details. They cite as examples. The $10 billion in 5 years for clean energy sources actually translates to $2 billion per year, of which the greatest majority are going to the president's two favorite sources, clean coal, and his new best friend, nuclear, leaving a few hundred million for others such as solar, wind, and geothermal. The 22% increase in clean energy research, which has averaged about $1.5 billion per year, is a bit misleading as it is a comeback position following a 5% cut, so therefore the total growth in investment turns out to be less than $200 million per year. And that 75% needs a little deeper analysis, as currently the U.S. gets about 20% of its oil from the Middle East. Therefore, the carefully crafted 75% of Middle Eastern oil translates into a 15% increase in sources other than the Middle East. Now, where do we go for that? Particularly if Venezuela continues its errant ways? Does the name Anwar perhaps come to mind? We'll keep you posted. Last week we talked with a researcher at the San Diego Zoo who said that a report about the future of orangutans had just come out and things did not look too good. Well, the report is out and she was right. Things do not look so good. Due to the loss of forests for lumber and palm oil plantations, the orangutan is reaching a point where the genetic diversity needed to keep a healthy population alive may be reaching its de minimis. At a certain point, genetic defects become in a sense concentrated in the remaining population, which cannot support a population large enough to survive. Based on these new findings, which shorten the time until extinction will occur, the orangutan is in very serious trouble. In response, various international agencies are proffering demands for a rapid restoration of the Malaysian forest in which the orangutans exist and the establishment of wildlife corridors to permit the open movement of individuals. It is becoming increasingly clear that a time of significant loss of some of the world's most amazing animals is accelerating to a head in the future which grows nearer and nearer, faster and faster. Do something today. Take a stand. Speak out. Speak up. And take action. Astrophysicists are going planetary as they try to decide if we are going to add a 10th planet to our solar system, which, as anyone who has attended grade school well knows to be Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto, and now UB313. A little-known debate has raged for years as to whether Pluto should in fact be considered a true planet, as opposed to merely a large chunky rock twirling amongst the Kuiper Belt, 97 times as far from the Sun as our little chunk named planet Earth. In reality, scientists have been able to prove that UB313 is 435 miles larger than Pluto. So, what's the question, some ask? And it gets complex because then some ask, so why is Pluto a planet? science. It's based on facts. And in another dimension, last year the world's smallest fish was discovered in the collection of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography in San Diego. The little anglerfish was just smaller than a quarter of an inch, which is quite an accomplishment for such a complex fish that includes a dangling lure with which to attract its prey, which quickly end up inside its gigantic little mouth. Well, scientists in France announced that they have a fully grown male fish that is, okay, 6/100ths of an inch longer, but its body is so thin that it is transparent. And then, as if that weren't bad enough, Australian scientists have a smallest fish that gets pretty darn close to San Diego's smallest fish. The debate is just how small is small. Is it smallest in length or smallest in bulk? Ponder that. I hope you're able to sleep tonight. And that's the news. And now a few reminders. Next week, we head on out to Yellowstone Park and talk about the status of the reintroduced Yellowstone wolf pack. Things don't look too good for them right now, and we'll give you an up-to-the-minute assessment of what's going on there. And then it's down to New Mexico to talk about the effects that the new push for oil and natural gas exploration is having on a sixth-generation ranching family. It, too, is a story that needs to be told. And that is what we do here each week, bringing you the voices of the earth so that we can know the state of our world, our wonder, and the challenges we must face. It's here every week on the Wild Side News. So I encourage each of you to help spread the news. Tell your friends and encourage them to tune in each week. We'll be glad you did. Thanks.
A number of years back, I lived in New Mexico on 16 beautiful acres south of Santa Fe, across the deep arroyo, where our good friends Rick and Phil and a dog named Apache. She was a beautiful silver Siberian husky, one of the most beautiful dogs I've ever seen. One of the first times I met Apache was at a party at Rick and Phil's place. I remember talking with someone late in the evening when the edges get a little fuzzy. I turned to find this elegant, smiling-faced dog following our conversation. She was absolutely upright. Her face was at our level. She kept herself upright by standing on her two hind paws and touching my arm so lightly with one paw that I could not feel it. Now, we had a wonderful dog, a Navajo dog named Bean Dog. Bean Dog and Apache became great friends. Bean Dog acted like a wise old grandma to this young female from across the arroyo. As fine a dog as Bean Dog was, Apache was a natural rebel. Rick and Phil had chickens, magic chickens that laid pastel eggs. But Apache didn't hesitate killing any hen that flew out of the pen, and this was the beginning of real trouble for her. For you see, Rick and Phil also had a bright green parrot that would fly out each morning and return each evening. Once, when Rick and Phil were gone, the house sitter discovered the great parrot dead. Apache had, for some reason, killed it. When Rick and Phil returned, this was the last straw, and although Phil was ready to kill her, he didn't, and Apache was taken to the Santa Fe Humane Society and adopted by a doctor in Taos, 80 miles north of Santa Fe. And it was about this time that Bean Dog one day walked away, as dogs do, and never returned. We knew that our neighbors were upset with Apache, so we went to talk with them about adopting Apache to find out, but unfortunately found out, that they had already gotten rid of her. In a few days, something magic happened. Apache returned. She knew where home was, and within approximately 3 days had traveled cross-country over 100 miles to be back home. She had simply shown up one day with that smile. It was the smile that worked the magic. So we felt it sort of an omen that we were meant to have her and imagined that we could get her to understand that she was to now cross the arroyo to live with us forever. I will always remember how she followed us across the deep arroyo, and from that day forward, lived with us. Apache was a dog of great passion and imagination. One day Apache disappeared. She was gone for days. Then suddenly she reappeared, excited and smiling, greeted us wildly, gulped down a bowl of water, wolfed down the food that we had put down for her, and then went bounding wildly out the back door, running full speed towards the deep arroyo. We went across the arroyo to Rick and Phil's, but they hadn't seen her for a long time. Days went by, and then one day the same scene happened all over again. Leaping into the house, greeting, drinking, feeding, and gone. Then the pattern changed. She would visit almost every day. It was as if she was excited about something. So finally one day, when she dashed off, we followed her, and she ran off, her lithe legs flying as she ran across the land and quickly into the deep arroyo. We followed, but she was gone. We called and whistled and called again, but she was nowhere to be found. In the deep arroyo, there was an old coyote den, which dug back deep into the mud bank about 10 feet. Could she possibly be there? We needed a flashlight, and when we returned and shone the light into the deep hole, two eyes and that smiling face beamed from within. This continued for weeks. We learned that she was likely waiting for puppies, but alas, as days turned to weeks, no puppies, and then one day she was back. Not as exhilarated, but she was back. She had been caught up in a false pregnancy. She was an animal of raw instinct. She grew and matured, and false pregnancies happened about once a year. We grew accustomed to her disappearances, but she was a great dog, and mellowed a bit with age. But not much. She could run like a cyclone when she wanted to. One day, we came home to find Apache peering steadily like a pointer, her attention fixed on something under the house. This was the first time I'd seen this behavior. As I followed her gaze, I noticed a rattlesnake coiled up by our outdoor propane bottles. I thought he'd scare it off by throwing a few rocks into the bottles, but this only drove the snake deeper under the house. Realizing this could be a long wait, I determined I had to remove the snake from potentially under my feet permanently, and I did. One day, Apache returned at the end of a desert summer's day and could barely make her way up the steps. She was walking in slow motion. One foot moved slowly up to the next step, then her body trembled up, and this continued on into the house. She inched her way across the wooden floor, then dropped. Her breathing was heavy and burdened, and we noticed that her neck seemed to be swollen. It took a while to notice the two small punctures on her black lower lip. She had been bitten by a rattler. We drove her off to the vet, who gave her the antibodies that might help her live, and then we waited, and the effects of the venom were ferocious. Her head and neck swelled until she did not even look like a dog, and she laid motionless for 2 days. Then, on the third day, she managed to get to her feet and slowly made her way to the door. She trembled down the steps and then slowly walked away. It was difficult leaving that day for appointments in Santa Fe, but we had to, and we figured nature would handle this. When we returned in the evening, there was no Apache. It was a long, awkward night. In the morning, we headed out, calling and looking, but finally made a slow, rambling walk back to the house. Tears in our eyes, our beloved magic Apache was gone. As we sat on the steps, a familiar sound caused us to look up and out, and like a crazed angel, Apache ran at us, leaped past us in one bounding, joyous flight, came back and licked our faces and danced and smiled. Apache was back, as always in her own spirited way, and she was completely restored. No swelling, no slowness. It was as if a miracle cure had taken place. We never came to know how this happened, or what made her so well so suddenly, but I've always imagined that that evening she met a coyote trickster who recognized her for what she was, a spirit of the wind and earth, beautiful, lithe, and he worked his magic. The creatures on this earth, they are so much more than we generally acknowledge. I personally believe each one is as present in their world and in their self as anyone I meet. And this will be how I know the world for all of my life on this earth. For me, my belief gives me more than I could ever lose, even wondering if I am right or wrong. It really does not matter. It is a divine gift that enriches my soul.
Our wanton anthropomorphizing continues as we head on up to Montana and look at dogs who save our lives. When your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.